Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David.
And I'm your co-host, Maya Darren Paul Hornby.
Today, we're talking to Finn Stevenson, co-founder and CEO of Flock Health. We're talking about reshaping physiotherapy in the NHS. Welcome to the pod, Finn. You're obviously the co-founder and CEO of Flock Health, and that's the UK's first AI-powered physiotherapy clinic. Flock provides video call appointments for NHS patients to access back pain treatment. Actually, I need that. I woke up today with like a not very great back, so I might be taking advantage of your service.
You're not alone.
Yeah. And it's just you get old and you just sleep wrong and then you hurt. You do initial assessment and triage. You've got over 300,000 people currently on NHS wait lists for MSK physiotherapy. What's MSK? If you could maybe define that real quick.
Musculoskeletal, bone and joint pain and problems.
Okay.
You think your backs, your knees, your hips, your shoulder, you know, musculoskeletal as the group is, the combination.
Got it.
And kind of now the by far largest cause of disability.
Well, it counts for a third of GP appointments. So that's a stunning stat. And one quarter of those patients waiting over 3 months to be seen. I can't imagine like living with the pain I had this morning, for example, for three months. And you've reported that over 30 million working days are lost to musculoskeletal MSK conditions every year in the UK. And what Flock does, it offers a solution to treat patients sooner and simultaneously free up capacity in existing services. Was that a good summary?
It's pretty good, yeah. You should do this more often.
And as I'm sure we'll go more into detail in our conversation later on, you've just completed several successful trials with NHS Trust, so congratulations. And you are planning to roll out the first NHS AI-run physiotherapy clinic later this year. So your interest in back pain can be traced a decade back when you did your medical degree's dissertation on scoliosis treatments and then completed an MSc in MSK with a focus on spine conditions. So yeah, welcome to the pod, Finn. Thank you for making the time.
Finn, I have to ask, when you talk to people, do they like sit up more straight when they talk to you? They must do, because I just did this after reading the bio. Do they do it?
I think people probably do. I mean, I'm probably the worst patient there, because you can see me now.
Your
listeners can't, but I'm like slumped in my chair for now, feeling self-conscious about it.
So in 2023, Flock went through regulatory approval as a healthcare provider, so it can deliver full treatment pathways directly to patients. How significant was this step and what did the process entail?
I guess this is kind of unusual for a health tech company. The more typical thing is you build the piece of innovative software and then you kind of license or sell that to healthcare providers to deliver. And that's historically been the way that these things happen. I think we'd seen the problem or the challenge with that is you're left with, you know, as the healthcare provider, so for example, an NHS trust, you're left trying to deploy and deliver a thing that you didn't build and can't get into. And as the health tech company, you're unable to directly treat your own patients. And so you've got that sort of disintermediate, you know, you're not able to directly impact their experience and their care. And that comes with a whole host of sort of pathway and efficiency for patients and the sort of experience and access that they can have. So we felt really strongly early on that we wanted to be both. So we consider ourselves first and foremost a healthcare provider. We happen to build and operate sophisticated software systems, but purely because it enables us to deliver better care at greater scale. And for us, that's really important. It's about being able to, you know, take the care we know works and deliver it at the scale it's required, which is an enormous challenge in community care. In terms of what it involved, it means that as a company, we're, you know, I guess both from an operational perspective and from a regulatory perspective, it was just a lot more upfront complexity before you're able to actually start delivering products and services. So as a company, our software is regulated as a medical device because it's automating clinical decision making, but the company is then also regulated as essentially a hospital or healthcare provider. So we went through CQC approval, which is the provider regulator in England. So they're also the regulator for, you know, trusts and care homes and, you know, GP practices, for example. Yeah, I guess in terms of impact on us, it's more front-loaded regulatory and operational complexity, having to build out those functions in a not traditional kind of software company functions. But the upside is we're then able to provide much, much greater value to our NHS partners in terms of, you know, partnering as a fellow provider, but also to our patients where we're directly delivering care to them and, you know, on a daily basis. across the regions that we now operate in.
Sure. And in terms of sort of encountering that complexity, you guys are the first digital MSK provider to be approved by the CQC, which is the Care mm-hmm. Quality Commission for our listeners. But were there other sort of digital health providers who had offered sort of a template for a plan about how you go about gaining approval and sort of navigating the complex processes, or were you sort of learning as you went?
There's certainly other digital providers in different areas. So for example, some of the hospital at home type providers have been through CQC approval previously. I think anywhere you're directly wanting to deliver care as the company within a regulated scope of activity, you must be CQC approved to deliver that care in England. So there was a little bit of a blueprint, but obviously we worked closely with the CQC as part of that initial assessment process, and you know they were, I think, you know, really positive about this sort of service becoming available. You know, they are keen to see new and improved care pathways actually reach patients. And so they worked with us to sort of take us through that initial process.
Want to pivot the conversation a bit to automation. You've spoken about how you needed to change Flock's decision automation approach in order to capture like the full complexity and nuance of clinical reasoning. So I wanted to understand, like, when did you realize this, and how did you ensure that the new model was demonstrably safe to deploy at scale without human supervision?
Yeah, great question. Maybe if I rewind slightly to sort of like, why does automation even matter?
Yeah.
Like, why automate this stuff? And I think in our space, it's because there's a fundamental supply demand mismatch. So you know, conditions like MSK pain, back pain, these are very, very common. They cause a sort of hugely disproportionate amount of debilitation and suffering, impact on quality of life, but also broader socioeconomic impact mm-hmm. in pretty much any population of pretty much any country you can pick. The interesting thing with these conditions is actually, you know, we understand how to manage them quite well. Like, you know, if we had, you know, a few thousand people in the UK a year with back pain, they'd all get amazing care and none of them would have back pain anymore, probably. Mm. The difficulty is just you've got such a large number of people needing care, and the good care requires fast access. You know, there's no, if you're sitting on the definition of chronic pain clinically is pain for 12 weeks. If you've got longer than a 12-week wait across the entire country, you have a system that by definition wow. is only seeing people who already have chronic pain,
but also like putting people into a space where they like you're causing them to almost have chronic pain by not treating
The timer is just, you know, the clock is running. Uh-huh. And the faster you can give people access to the right care, the more avoidable all of that downstream impact becomes. Mm-hmm. Once you give them access, you know, to give people effective MSK care, it's got to be frequent and multidisciplinary. So you need multiple clinical disciplines. You know, it's not just about exercise prescription, it's also behavioral change coaching, psychosocial interventions, mm-hmm. mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, for example, requires a number of disciplines with some, you know, with frequency, ideally probably, you know, weekly interaction. And if you've got, you know, such a high proportion of the population seeking this care, you can't deliver that kind of model or that kind of, you know, care access and frequency with short of retraining half the country as physiotherapists. It's just not possible. Mm. And so that's why automation matters. Like if you're gonna hit that gold standard of fast, frequent, multidisciplinary, you have to essentially scale that clinician expertise and make the delivery of gold standard care less bottlenecked, less mm-hmm. dependent on clinician availability, because clinicians are a scarce resource.
Yeah.
And we need to kind of scale their impact. We need to do a better job of scaling their impact. So that's why automation matters fundamentally. Yeah. You know, as with all of these things, I guess when we set out to sort of build an autonomous physiotherapy clinic, it of course turns out to be more complex than you expect. And we learned a lot of really interesting things that became part of how we now deliver care today. So specifically on the decision automation side, we ended up developing a new domain-specific programming language mm-hmm. specifically to describe clinical reasoning. And this is, you know, tied into the fairly, you know, somewhat unique requirements of healthcare decision automation. You can't use approaches like, you know, large language model where, you know, it will be wrong convincingly in a proportion of, you know, the time. That's sort of fine if you're asking it a, you know, harmless question, whereas sure. if it's giving a patient direct, unsupervised, you know, healthcare, that's not okay. So you need ways of ensuring correct behavior, and a domain-specific language gives you that, because you know, you, fundamentally, if you control the language of the thing, you control what it's capable of expressing, and so you can design safety in at the most fundamental layer. So we developed this language that our decision engine is created in, and that now allows us to, you know, provide entirely consistent, reliable, safe decision automation for clinical reasoning, which so sort of huge deal for us in terms of being able to then bring that through into care today.
Yeah, this one really resonates with me, and I should have discussed this before, Maya, but I didn't. But like, you know, I had some major back issues, like starting kind of end of 2022 into 2023, and I think it was like L3, L4, L4, L5, and then there were like some deep like musculofascial like stuff in like my, like I don't remember, but you know, my journey was going to like a physio in Wandsworth. I went to an NHS clinic and saw like one physiotherapist, and it was just like a very cursory appointment. But like, I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to have the financial resources to surround myself with this multidisciplinary team of folks who eventually like healed me and went on to see this osteopath who himself is just incredible and does, we do clinical Pilates, we do acupuncture, he does massage. He even does like talk therapy as well, because, you know, a lot of the issues I was facing were stress induced as well. So I was able to like build basically what you're talking about with like humans around me, because I have the resources. And this was like fully outside of the NHS. So like what you're describing is totally speaking to me in terms of my personal medical journey.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, so to hear you went through that, but I'm glad you're able to access that kind of care.
Yeah.
You know, as you say, the reality for the vast majority of people is that they just cannot access that. And it's not because the NHS doesn't want to deliver it or because clinicians in the NHS don't know that, you know, that's what they want to do. It's just such a constraint. It's just such a mismatch. You know, if you've got this many people, so, you know, in Europe, it's about 1 in 3 adults a year will have a significant episode of just back pain.
Yeah.
And half of them are going to seek care from their healthcare professional. Mm-hmm. So you've got, you know, 1 in 6 adults every year looking for care in these areas. And that's just not viable to deliver in a sort of national healthcare system with both the sort of people and people constraints and financial constraints. So, as you know, it's exactly what we're trying to achieve, is to basically democratize that kind of world-class care that you were able to access, make that accessible to everyone when they need it. And I mean, your story resonates for me. It's actually not so, I think as you said in your introduction, I studied medicine. After medical school, I actually was a full-time athlete for a few years. So I was in a not resource-constrained environment where you have kind of full-time healthcare. And for me, when I left rowing, like having had a bunch of MSK problems, and it never been a problem because you kind of see the, you know, you see the physio the same day and every day, and then you're racing again a week later. When I left that environment and found myself in the, you know, in the NHS, essentially, it was a huge wake up call in terms of what it looks like for the vast majority of the population who, you know, just don't have access to that kind of care. We fundamentally try to change that.
Another analogy too, like my dad's in the, you know, veteran system in the US, which is like our version of socialized medicine in the US. And, you know, he's surrounded by a care team. Like I literally have a conference call every quarter with his care team, and it's like a social worker and a, you know, a psychotherapist and, you know, the activities person and the, you know, the physiotherapist and like everyone. Yeah. And it's just like, wow, like this is arguably this is what veterans and older adults need. But like, why doesn't everyone have that?
I mean, that's it for us. It's exactly why we're kind of so passionate about community health. It's so often overlooked as an area of, you know, doesn't see necessarily the same levels of innovation and funding as the sort of acute hospital medicine, but actually it's probably the biggest opportunity to actually impact people's quality of life.
When you say community, can you define that for our listeners? Like community healthcare, what does that mean?
Yeah, so it's the healthcare that exists outside the hospital or should exist outside the hospital. So the sorts of things you're describing where we're, you know, treating people in the community rather than having them coming, you know, into a hospital for specialist diagnostics, procedures, prescribing. You know, some people in their health journey need to be in a hospital and need to receive treatment there, but actually most of the conditions that affect people are things that could either be prevented or better managed earlier in their presentation by pushing that care out into the community and kind of meeting the people where they are. And, you know, these, I guess, particularly for areas that we're working in, so MSK, pelvic health conditions, these are areas where, you know, actually what's needed is not kind of new diagnostics, it's not new drugs, it's not fancy new surgical procedures. It's, you know, we actually know the stuff that works really well, is really effective. We just need to get it to the people that need it when they need it
and where they need it. And like, I think this really resonates with me, because like part of the reason, like my dad's one of those cases where he's like in a, you know, a care home, but he's like, right, he's like an edge case. Like he can move around, he can do a lot, but like, because some of his care needs are sort of what's available in that care home, he's in that care home with a lot of people who really, really need it. But like, ostensibly, if community care was set up the way that it should be, like he could be at home with us and have all those care needs met if there were just a few more bits that were like, you know, helping him with his meds or like, you know, whatever it is. But that really resonates with me, because I think there are a lot of folks, especially folks who are carers of older people, who they've had to put that person in a really expensive care home or something like that because that community care isn't there. So I think that that point you're making is really, it has real life implications for lots of families, lots of people. So
And you mentioned sort of psychosocial treatment. Would you be able to give a few examples of what that looks like for MSK?
Definitely. So, and I mean, there's now pretty good recognition, but it's taken time in the field clinically to for this to happen, that MSK pain conditions, particularly, you cannot view them through a purely, you know, biological or sort of like injury mechanism lens. That your experience of pain is not only impacted by everything else in your life, so your sort of social, psychological, emotional factors, but this is also a cycle. So, you know, the pain impacts those factors, which in turn impact the pain. And I mean, the analogy I often use is if you kind of recall all the times in your life you've stubbed your toe, and they're, you know, it's probably a pretty similar mechanism of injury or kind of like amount of like quantifiable physical pain, but how that feels to you in the moment is so different depending on the context that you do it in. You know, if you stub your toe, like running out of the house to like have fun, you know, do something with your friends, like that feels entirely different from stubbing your toe when you're like cold and it's dark outside and you're by yourself and you're like not feeling great that day. They're entirely different experiences to the exact same physical sort of nociceptive input. And you know, that becomes a cycle in pain conditions, because the pain doesn't fade. You know, it's not like you stub your toe and it disappears a couple of minutes later. If the pain remains, then there is more opportunity for it to create cycles. And so to really manage and sort of treat pain particularly, we have to consider the sort of holistic picture of a person and go beyond, you know, exercise prescription and physical interventions and look at the other things that in their life are affecting the pain itself. So how they're sleeping, their exercise, their sort of level of social engagement. And these things become like a spiral of decline. You know, people who are in chronic pain start withdrawing from things like social engagement, from physical activity. They fear worsening the pain and therefore, you know, reduce their exercise, reduce like the amount that they go out of that. And of course, this just makes the pain worse and becomes a spiral of decline. The key for the sort of non-physical interventions in pain pathways are like, you've got to flip that spiral around. So you've got to, you know, because it becomes then a positive reinforcement. You know, actually you start seeing improvement in pain, which in turn then like encourages engagement with activity, with, you know, the things that you care about as an individual, which in turn reduces the impact that the pain's having you on. And, you know, now you have this positive cycle of recovery. So a huge amount of what we do that's valuable in our patients' pathways is not the exercise prescription. It's not the physical interventions. It's the non-physical stuff. It's helping them understand their pain, their experience of pain better, understand their own body, understand like why they feel a particular way, and that's not unusual or abnormal. That it's something that's entirely normal, and that they can understand and change. Like changing the way they frame or sort of see the impact of that pain on their life in the future, like helping them reframe that. And then some pretty like concrete techniques. So I mentioned it earlier, but one of the techniques that is particularly effective, or we've seen to be particularly effective in our pathway, is mindfulness-based cognitive therapies. So things like three-minute breathing space technique, like you can give people, these are tools that you give people that they can take with them, you know, away from their treatment and use, you know, in their lives going forward. And yeah, it's I think, if you're not addressing those factors, you would never make a dent in pain on the whole.
Yeah. Obviously, there's huge demand on these healthcare systems that are increasing. And you've stated your goal as you want to build the world's best community healthcare, you know, sort of provider. Yeah. How do you see yourself feasibly scaling into, you know, all these other related health conditions? And yeah, how are you going to do that? How are you going to make that work?
Yeah, we've started, I guess. Yeah. So I guess we started with back pain because it's within MSK, certainly it's the biggest single condition just in terms of impact on people, but also cost in the system. And when you're trying to get this sort of frontier innovation off the ground, it helps to start with the biggest, most painful, in this case, literally problem for a large number of people. But certainly we're the underlying technology, so the domain-specific language, the approach to clinical reasoning automation, and then also the sort of real-time video assembly. So the way we then interact with patients is to simulate these video calls where essentially they have a video call with a physio, but our side of the call is a server, and it's stitching together and assembling video in real time to respond to what they're saying, doing, feeling. Those pieces of underlying technology are clearly much more generalizable. So we have started already training the same system in other conditions that share similar problems. So women's pelvic health conditions, really good example. Again, really significant challenges around speed and frequency of access to care, but also other MSK pathways like hip and knee osteoarthritis. These are pathways that at the moment you see people having joint replacements earlier than they need to, and having worse outcomes than they should have, because actually if we were managing them as well as we could in the community while it was at mild to moderate level, we'd delay the need for a joint replacement. And then if they were having really effective prehabilitation in the run-up to a joint replacement if they eventually needed one, and then the proper sort of post-operative rehabilitation, you could totally change those pathways, which is great for patients, but it's also really important for the system as a whole. So yeah, work is well underway on those kind of additional pathways, and we essentially add verticals to our clinic services with both existing and new partners as we grow. Being able to actually take this through a regulatory process, a regulatory clearance to be able to deliver care is pretty novel, like very early days of it. There's sort of first autonomous clinical system in this kind of use environment to be deployed, certainly in the UK, like probably more broadly. But yeah, exciting times for sort of the impact that can have on healthcare more at scale.
And in terms of broadening that impact, whether within healthcare or across other sectors, you were recently invited to be part of the AI roundtable at Number 10. So would you be able to give us an understanding of sort of challenges and opportunities that founders encounter when building sort of growing AI companies in the UK?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it was a really interesting event at Number 10. I think, there was good recognition from the new government that we need economic growth, and economic growth because it fuels everything else that you want to do as a government, right? And I think economic growth doesn't, or you can't rely on the existing like stable industries to produce significant growth above inflation. And so when you're looking at fundamentally shifting into like a faster growing GDP and economic value, I think like it's the sort of breakthrough new sectors where there's particularly significant potential to do that. And I think that's what that's how they're viewing AI, like correctly, is an opportunity to benefit from a country like across the board by becoming their explicit goal, as they sort of framed in this, is to be Matt Clifford's doing a huge amount of work in the space at the moment, but to essentially try and make the UK one of the best places in the world to build an AI company. I think in terms of the challenges and opportunities, there are a lot of challenges. We're currently on a number of areas, we're like pretty far behind. If we're kind of like brutally honest about it, access to like infrastructure, the sort of state of the art data centers and compute, we're quite far behind other countries. There are areas where we do have real opportunity to kind of be world leading. I actually think healthcare is one of those.
Why is that?
I think we have a fairly unique system in terms of the way the NHS is set up, in that you have a group of sort of a large number of like fairly consistent organizations and a national scale system. So your ability to sort of, from a data perspective, from a volume perspective, like your ability to sort of scale within a single market that's actually not a single market, so like a consistent market of like a large number of individual players, I think is a big opportunity. I think also as a country, we have actually been at the forefront of a lot of like life science and health innovation. So from kind of talent on both the, we've got deep sort of technical talent in, you know, as a country, but also on the life science and healthcare, I think have really, really strong talent density. And so there is an opportunity to do something, you know, very meaningful there, but there's a, you know, a lot of work to do to kind of realize that.
Wanted to kind of loop back a bit to this expansion piece and like the work that you're doing to expand across multiple different verticals and the sort of community healthcare side of things, but also connected to growth. We're, you know, growth strategy agency. We'd be remiss if we didn't sneak one of these in here. But just curious to hear a bit more about your growth strategy, you know, where you've been, where you are now, and where you're looking to grow, how you're looking to, you know, feasibly scale these verticals and just, yeah, grow as a company.
Certainly a key thing to consider for companies like us is, you know, the scale at which we deliver care directly impacts the quality of care. Mm. And that is the inverse of traditional healthcare. Like traditional healthcare is like the quality of traditional healthcare is constrained by the limited resource that is, you know, healthcare professionals. In this kind of approach where there's significant automation, significant data-driven decision-making, you can deliver better care. It's essentially the quality is uncapped by scale. Like it will continue to get better and better as you deliver more and more. And so growth becomes, you know, important. It makes growth even more integral to a mission of the company than it would in kind of, you know, I guess any company where like, okay, you've got to grow to some extent. Mm. But for us, growth is like fundamentally part of the mission. Like the whole point of this is like to deliver at scale and, you know, and across the multiple conditions that it's needed. And so for us, that will involve expansion into new clinical areas. So I mentioned some of the domains that we're training the system in at the moment, but also expansion into other markets. So, you know, we are particularly focused on, you know, population scale systems, so large health systems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is the sort of problems we are trying to solve or working on solving are certainly not unique to a UK environment. Mm-hmm. They're very consistently problems across the globe, and, you know, we certainly aim to, you know, build towards addressing that across a very wide range of settings. Mm-hmm.
And how do you respond to kind of skepticism from, you know, like patients or even clinicians about like scaling that care and, you know, leveraging AI and automation to kind of, you know, in some cases like replace or augment or, you know what I mean, what the sort of skilled health workers can do? Sure, you get some pushback on that. So like, how do you respond to it?
Yes, I think the first thing to be really clear on is that this isn't about replacing traditional services. It's these, you know, this kind of AI-driven delivery will never be the right thing for all patients in all pathways, in all settings. It will be the right thing for like some patients in some conditions, in some settings, and like where it's right, it's not only better for those patients, it's actually better for the patients who need to be in the traditional setting, because now they can see that professional, you know, sooner, for longer, and with less burnout. And you know, for us, it's totally about working in parallel, in partnership with traditional services, so that the right patients get the right care in the right place from the right kind of service, and that, you know, by significantly automating some of the really high volume pathways, that we can free up, you know, that scarce resource in the traditional pathway to focus on where it adds the most value and where it's most important. I think, you know, clinicians are rightly cautious initially when you introduce the idea of, you know, okay, there's a piece of, you know, you've been delivering care this particular way for like decades, pretty consistently. Mm-hmm. And it's all, you know, been entirely dependent. You know, every interaction has been like a human in a one-to-one ratio with a patient, whether that's in a room, on a call, on a video, like it's a one-to-one interaction and the human makes all the decisions. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of saying, okay, well, actually there's this, like, we can now do it this other way where we're going to put a piece of software, and a piece of software is going to like automate a whole load of this and interact directly with the patient, like treat the patient. The patient's going to build a relationship with a piece of software. Mm-hmm. Like that's their care relationship. And it may be the only interaction they have from like the start to the finish of their care pathway of like multiple months. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a totally different model. And clinicians are rightly cautious about, you know, how can you be sure this is safe? How can you be sure that the, you know, the care will be effective? Like what will patients think about it? You know, and I think, but you know, I have to say, you know, every group of clinicians we've worked with as part of deploying this in now a number of NHS sites, like that caution turns to sort of excitement and understanding. You know, I think you have to work together. They, you know, they have all the right questions, and you've got to work through, you know, okay, how is it tested? Like, how is safety managed? Like, how do you do the, you know, how do you assess and mitigate risk? Like, how is it actually deployed in practice?
Mm.
You know, clinicians come to see the value because the problem is so familiar to them. Like, they've all, you know, been in that very, very constrained environment and not able to deliver the kind of care that they went into clinical practice to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they see the need for this and, you know, rightly see it as something that should improve the sort of quality of their working life and the sort of care that they're able to deliver. From patients' perspective, you know, I guess the caveat to this is, you know, this should be a choice. Like, you shouldn't be forcing patients down these kind of care routes. It should be offered as a choice. We now know, like, very convincingly that if you offer this as a choice, a very significant proportion of patients will choose it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're offering someone the difference between, you know, what could be like weeks of waiting for a very short appointment, you know, and like a pretty constrained amount of follow-up, versus like, okay, do you want an appointment today? Like, well, you know, sort of world-class clinical standard, like right now,
mm-hmm.
And then like start treatment straight away. Patients will choose that. And I think there's been a huge shift culturally in kind of AI and automation becoming a very mainstream thing that whereas even like a couple of years ago, to the sort of average, you know, average person walking down the street, the idea of like interacting with an autonomous system and expecting it to do something useful and valuable in your life would have been quite alien. It's like not something that many people like outside of tech were would have thought was like particularly normal, whereas that's not the case now. And so we've seen patients really embrace it, you know, perhaps even to a surprising amount in terms of how much it seems like a sort of natural shift or a natural thing for them. And I think a huge part of that is from the more sort of mainstream AI applications that have sort of made that commonplace.
It's funny to like feel the future happening. Like, I find myself talking to Siri a lot more and like just chucking questions into ChatGPT. And sometimes I think it's like, oh, I don't know about this. And then it happens and you embrace it and it can actually elevate, you know, the work of the clinicians and obviously the transformation of the patient.
Yeah,
so it's cool to see your angle on that as well.
And also just adds importance to the work that you've done in terms of talking to policymakers.
Yeah.
Okay, to sort of round off this discussion, I'd love if we could just ask you a couple of quick fire questions.
Got it.
I'll start you with a nice easy one. If you could found another tech startup, what would it be and why?
If I were like somehow banned from working in this space,
it would
100% in healthcare, it would be trying to build something to properly align the incentives between healthcare delivery and the funding model. I think like we should be in healthcare buying outcomes, and yet that is universally not what happens.
What tech invention makes you the most excited right now?
Right now, I think some of the recent progress in like practical nuclear fusion.
Wow.
So I think like obviously this is not a new field, but it's like the last 18 months have seen like surprising leaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess like very fundamentally, most of recent human progress has been like somewhat dependent on energy.
Mm.
And so the like ability, you know, and we've got a world where like that is still like pretty unevenly distributed. But also there's, you know, significant unmet need still at a time where like meeting that need has this like enormous trade-off with kind of global warming and like impact on the planet and the climate. So I think, yeah, like the ability to essentially produce like almost limitless, very clean energy would be a very, very fundamental unlock.
That would be wild.
Next phase of human growth.
The next one, who is a literal human, small L, small H, who's been integral to your career journey that maybe you want to shout out? Maybe we can invite them on the pod.
I've got to give a shout out to my co-founder, Rick.
Nice.
So I think, building a company is hard. Like, I think it'd be pretty tough to imagine doing it alone. And I think, that's, you know, been hugely impactful. I think probably also give a shout out to my wife, Erin.
There you go.
It's when you decide to like do a startup, it's not only you that it affects. And so it's like very grateful for that as well.
Absolutely. Got your work co-founder and your home co-founder. There you go. Cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Depending on the week, like Rick probably gets more time. Yeah.
Final question, is there an inspirational quote that stuck with you throughout your journey in tech or entrepreneurship?
I don't know whether it's inspirational, but a quote that sticks with me a lot is one that one of our investors like gave me very early on in the journey, which was like nothing is ever as good or bad as it first appears. And I think in like an entrepreneurial journey or in kind of company building more generally, like it's the roller coaster is so extreme, you know, like you live with this like permanent paradox. And I think like finding a way to like figure both of those out and like somewhat, you know, minimize the like seesaw impact that would otherwise have on you psychologically, I think is pretty important. So yeah. Not very inspirational, but like useful maybe.
Cool. Well, I think that's it for today. This has been a fantastic conversation talking about reshaping physiotherapy in the NHS with Finn Stevenson, co-founder and CEO of Flock Health. It's been an awesome conversation, Finn. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time and great to meet you both.
And where can our listeners find out a bit more about Flock Health? You know, where can they find you on the interwebs and all that stuff?
So website, www.flock.health, follow us on LinkedIn, just search for Flock Health. There's probably the two main ones for kind of up-to-date news on us.
And that's Flock, F-L-O-K, right?
Yeah, correct.
Nice one. Cool. Yeah.
Get rid of the C.
We'll drop those links in the episode description and point folks to you. And we wish you the best in your continuing fundraising journey, your product development journey, and just the scaling across those verticals. It's super exciting. And this is why we do this podcast, to talk to founders like yourself who are building tech that really can save us. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben. We'll